from the Duck South Studios in Morgan City, Mississippi.
I love the smell of napalm in the morning.
I want to punch you in the face so bad right now.
This is the On the X podcast, powered by DuckSouth.com.
I didn't get a harumph out of that guy.
Get the governor a harumph.
What we've got here is failure to communicate.
Today's episode is brought to you by Advantage Multi from Bayer. Advantage Multi is veterinarians' number one choice in the prevention of heartworms, fleas, roundworms, hookworms, and whipworms. Treats and controls sarcoptic mange. Make sure your dog is protected by using Advantage Multi.
I said what I said and I'll stand by it to the death.
Ladies and gentlemen, can I please have your attention?
And now, here are your hosts, J. Paul Jackson.
You just love to hear yourself talk, don't you? Even when you're not saying anything.
Rocky LaFleur.
Yo, Adrian! Adrian!
Houston Kennedy.
Please, Houston, we have a problem.
And Josh Webb.
Coons! Well, raccoon's trying to get on our back porch. Mama just chased him off with a broom.
Hey folks, welcome to the On the X podcast, powered by DuckSouth.com. I'm J. Paul Jackson, coming to you this week from our studios in Morgan City, Mississippi, with co-hosts Rocky LaFleur, Josh Webb, and Houston Kennedy. And later in the broadcast, we'll be joined by our special guest this week, Mr. Freddie King. And guys, man, so good to be back on here this week and to have the whole crew back here, Josh, Houston, Rocky, all you guys along with me.
Yeah, it's really good to have everybody back. I know Josh and I's butt is really tired. We've been on the road all last week, but anyway, it's good to have everybody back on here.
I can tell you all sound so excited.
I hear Fat Boy.
That's me.
Oh, Lord, at least you answered to it.
I changed my profile pic on Duck South to a honey bun.
Well, look, I think Rocky and I, while we were on the road for a little while, a common theme that Rocky and I kept coming across was as we would stop for gas or something to eat, we could not figure out why a men's restroom happens to be the nastiest place on earth, because I tried to take
care
of
it. Oh, my God.
So I just want to know, J. Paul, you're on the road a lot. How often do you come across just
whoa, whoa, whoa,
situation?
But hold on. Before he answers that question, let me jump in here. Josh and I are on the road, and these men's bathrooms are not nasty. They're gross. Listen, there was one on the last part of our trip on our way back home this week that we stopped, and I looked around the corner to see if there was a lady possibly coming in, because I went in the women's restroom when I peeked my head in the men. I was scared my shoes were going to rot off. So,
well, let me tell you, to answer your question, Josh. Yeah, I'm on the road a lot. I mean, I spend over 100 nights a year on the road, and you know, Rocky, there've been restrooms that I stopped at and honestly wanted to change into the rubber boots that I had in the back of the truck before I even, you know, walked into the back. Over years, as a veteran traveler, I have developed a strategy. Okay, Rocky? And here it is. When I am on the road, I never stop at a rest area or at a truck stop or a convenience store in order to use the facilities. I'll stop to get fuel. I'll stop to let my dogs air themselves. You know, I'll stop to stretch my legs at a rest area, but I'm not going to go into a rest area bathroom. And here's the reason why, because there's no need to. When you're traveling, there's always one place that you can find a nice, clean, sanitary public restroom, and that is in the lobby of a hotel.
That's what I was going to say. There's no doubt. Hotel lobby, because nobody uses it.
Hey, Hampton Inn, Holiday Inn Express, Hilton Garden Inn, I mean, Days Inn, it doesn't matter. When you go into a hotel lobby, there's always going to be a men's room. There's always going to be a ladies' room. And they get cleaned every single morning. And just like Houston said, nobody uses them. And, you know, if you pick, like, the Hilton properties, when you walk through the door, you can always find a copy of USA Today. So you've actually got something you can read while you're there.
Because everybody's trying to get up to their room, right?
Nobody uses that. They don't have to. They've got one in their room.
All right, who's been watching the Olympics?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I know I have.
I watched a video on Facebook where these guys were diving, and they did cannonballs and belly flops.
Hey, did you see the Korean diver?
That's what I'm talking about.
You didn't see the Korean diver? You hadn't seen that video yet, J-Paul?
What?
Oh, man, this Korean diver is attempting this unusual dive, and he backflops. I'm talking about smooth, not a belly flop, but a smooth backflop. It's all
in
over
the
internet. Yes.
No, I've been watching the girls.
And his counterpart did the same thing, and they high-fived each other when they got out of the water.
Oh, my gosh. Well, hey, let me ask you this. If you didn't see the video of the Korean diver that did the backflop, did you happen to see the French gymnast that vaulted, and when he landed, he snapped his leg?
You would not let me show you that video while we were on the road to the day because just listening to the sound will make a man cringe. It was awful. It was like a .22 went off when it snapped. It was horrible.
Yeah, it was pretty bad. I did see that one, and man, I mean, it was one of those things where you just, ooh.
Yeah, I mean, Michael Phelps, all-time, I guess, the all-time medal count leader, all-time Olympian. I mean, he finished off his career, so he says. He said that in 2012, though, also.
I saw a cool picture with him today, and it was a comparison of his height versus the height of his gold medals. I think the total height, if you put each of his gold medals end-to-end on top of each other, is 7'3", and he's somewhere along the lines of 6'4". Now, that was a pretty cool analogy there.
Wow. Hey, the best part of the Olympics is coming up with track and field. That's my favorite part, man. Usain Bolt and the Gatlin guy from the United States, Justin Gatlin, that should be a lot of fun.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that, too. But I tell you, I've really enjoyed the swimming. And Phelps, I mean, obviously what he's done has been spectacular. But I'll tell you, the thing that really got me going the most of all was watching Ledecky not only set that new world record last night by more than a full body length, but she beat the silver medalist by over 11 seconds. And I think there'd been some mouthing before it by some of her competitors. So not only did she call them out on that, she put her money where her mouth was. And, you know, watching that yellow line and her staying a full body length behind it, and then it taking – you know, the time that it takes a man to run the 100 meters for the rest of the field to catch her or to actually touch, to me, that was the most impressive thing that I've seen yet.
Yeah, on that home stretch lap, I mean, she looked like she was swimming in a completely different pool than everybody else. She was just out there by herself enjoying it.
Hey, I'll tell you one. Look, Usain the Bolt from Jamaica. Usain, I think it's Usain. Is that right? Usain Bolt? Am I saying that right?
It begins with a U, and I'm looking here. I just pulled it up on my iPad. Usain Bolt, apparently, is the correct pronunciation.
Let me give you just a glimpse of his speed in where you can imagine it, okay? He's on the four-man, 4x100, which is a 400-meter relay, okay? He was timed at running 100 meters at right under 8.7 seconds. It's like 8.68. So that gives you just a glimpse of how fast he is. Now, it does take a man a little bit to get started in the 100 meters when you're just running the 100 meters. But he was at full speed, part of that, but he ran it in under 8.7 seconds. That's unbelievable.
If I was running, I would not be wearing a necklace because it smacks them in the face. I don't understand that. Running, and it's all smacking them all in the face, but all of the sprinters wear necklaces.
Yeah, I don't get that. And the girls have earrings on, and I don't understand that either. I brought that up to my wife the other night. I would want nothing, as very little as possible on me if I'm going to be doing that.
I told Josh last week when we were on the road, we were talking about the Olympics and running, and I said, Josh, if you ever see me running, you take off and run as fast as you can because something's after me.
Yeah, it's most likely something bad has happened for Rocky to be running.
One time when we were on the road together, I asked Rocky if he wanted to go for a run with me, and he said, what, somebody going to be chasing us? Because that's the only way I'm going to run.
I gave up running. It's been almost 20 years ago now. I ran enough when I was in high school and college. I don't need any more running now. I don't think my knees or my back could take it. Well, J. Paul, look, I've got a question from a Duck South user that I thought was pretty interesting, and they wanted to know what we thought the effects of El Nino and La Nina, how it affected duck hunting. And as smart as you are, I'm sure you can give us some scientific facts about El Nino and La Nina real fast.
You know, thank you, Adam. Right here is an area where I don't feel very smart, because what the scientists say about El Nino and La Nina and what you always see, I don't feel like it, you know, completely jives. I mean, if you take a look, first of all, El Nino and La Nina relate to the water temperature and the oscillation in the Pacific Ocean and warm phases and cold phases and how that affects climate globally, not just in North America, but globally. But so let's start with El Nino. As I understand it, El Nino is the warm phase. And in the months that we're duck hunting, December through February, it's characterized across the northern part of North America, Prairie Canada, and on up into Alaska, with warmer than average weather and fairly dry. Although in the Pacific Northwest, it tends to be wetter because you've got humidity that comes in there as a factor with warmer. But then across the southern United States during December through February, during El Nino, we typically see icy, cold, wet conditions. La Nina, which supposedly we are moving out of an El Nino phase into La Nina, but you know, the research that I looked at this recently because I was thinking about the fact we're coming out of El Nino, and in 2016 we had a record flood, which, you know, goes in with wet, but it also was very, very warm. I mean, we had one weekend toward the end of the season that we froze up here in Tennessee. And you know, La Nina is characterized by the opposite. We should be warm and dry in the south. But, you know, now the stuff that I was reading says that scientists are saying, you know, instead of 75% chance, maybe about a 50% chance of transitioning into a strong La Nina this fall. So, you know, El Nino in the south where we hunt, cold, wet, La Nina, warm, dry, December through February. But, I mean, this year we saw wet and still warm. What do you think, Rocky?
All right. Now that we've got the science out of the way, and I appreciate you, that's brought to you by NIT National Geographic and Dr. J. Paul Jackson. But anyway, let's get past the science, and let's look at the cold hard facts of, look, I've been keeping records since I started my guide service over 20 years ago. And the facts to me, if you look at these years of when we have El Nino and La Nina, if you gave me the choice, I would choose La Nina every time. Now, here's the reason why. In an El Nino year, it's usually wetter. And what that does for me as a duck hunter in the Mississippi Delta, it usually means that the rivers are higher, there's more water, the ducks are more spread out, and the biggest thing is the thing that people don't understand about the Mississippi River is there's so much land behind the levee. Now, that's timber and that's farmland. And when that Mississippi mm-hmm. River comes up and gets out of that river and it gets into all of that farmland, there's hundreds upon hundreds of thousands of acres up and down that Mississippi River that ducks can stay on. Well, they never make it to what I call the outer parts of the delta of the Mississippi River, or the central delta where I am in Mississippi. So, but, you know, the one thing that I will say about El Nino is usually in an El Nino year, if you're hunting flooded timber, it's usually some great hunting because the ducks have been out feeding all night, and about mid-morning, they're going to come crashing back into that timber, just coming back in to loft around. And, you know, so if it were up to me, I would choose a La Nina year every year. And, you know, the thing that I've always imagined as a duck hunter and doing this for so long is ducks usually stay, the majority of the ducks usually stay, you know, 100 miles away from the freeze line. And to me, that line on a normal year usually runs, you know, that I-40 across Memphis to Little Rock. And those ducks are north or south of that line, you know, 100 miles. And in the past three El Ninos that we've experienced, it's actually been warmer because it's been so wet in those years. It's actually been warmer. I know that science says that it's supposed to be cooler, but it was actually warmer according to the temperatures that I have. And that imaginary line is actually just shifted a little bit further north. So the ducks have been staying, not the I-40 interstate, but they've shifted more to the Missouri line, the northern part of Arkansas. Well, I'm a long ways away from the northern part of Arkansas. You know, one of the things I was visiting with Tony Vandermore, and that's not dropping a name, but one of the things he was telling me about last year, for an example, was he never lost his ducks. Yeah. The times that it did freeze up on him last year, he said they just sat in the Missouri River. So, you know, like I said, if you gave me the choice, I would choose La Nina every time.
Okay, so let's go back to the science then. I would agree with that for sure, because if we take a look at the science in La Nina, we're talking about drier and warmer in the south, but below average temperatures in the north. So you've got that freeze line that's going to be pushed down, and you've got dramatic differences. I mean, you've got across, you know, Prairie Canada and the Prairie United States during La Nina below average temperatures. So it's going to be really cold up there. And then in the south, we're going to have it milder, and it's going to be dry. So in those dry years, we don't have all the water between the levees, because just like you said, I mean, heck, here in Northwest Tennessee, where I live, you know, it's in a lot of places a mile and a half, 2 miles from the big levee across farmland all the way over to the Mississippi River. So, you know, you've got a big area that can hold water, as you said, Rocky, between the levees. In those drier years, you're going to have the birds more concentrated, and, you know, they're going to be pushed down. And I think, you know, at the very top of this discussion, it goes back to what I said earlier. Typically, El Nino would be wet and cold. Well, we've certainly seen the wet, but the last couple of years, we really haven't, you know, seen the cold. Or we saw it like in November and then a warming trend. You know, I can remember, you know, 2 years ago, maybe it was a Christmas time, I mean, Thanksgiving of 2014 or 2013, 2014, I believe it was, where we had, you know, a lot of stuff froze up at the very beginning of duck season, and then we thawed back out. Yeah, definitely, the La Nina follows exactly what you're saying. It's going to be better for us here because you've got the cold in the north and, you know, the dry and warmer in the south. Ducks are not going to be scattered out as much. They're going to be more concentrated. And a typical El Nino, we're going to have a lot of cold temperatures, but also, you know, precipitation in there. Unfortunately, the last couple haven't been typical, and that's why, you know, Tony's got ducks in mid-Missouri and northern Missouri until way late in the season.
Oh, yeah. But like I said, I would choose that La Nina year any time over El Nino. You know, water really hurts us where we are. Lots of water. Yeah, I mean, of course you need water, but lots of water really affects the hunting in the central part of the Mississippi Delta.
Sure. You can definitely have too much water. And we've seen this, you know, last year all across the Mississippi Valley. I mean, so much flooding going on. The ducks are just scattered. They're not going to be nearly as concentrated. So, yeah, I would have to agree with you. I mean, whether you're looking at it anecdotally like you are, or you're looking at it from, you know, the way that the science of the cold phase La Nina works, it's probably definitely going to be better for us duck hunting wise during La Nina.
Hey, but J. Paul, look, talking about questions coming from Duck South, I've got one from a Duck South user. They wanted me to ask a dog training question to you. Are you prepared to throw up some knowledge, some hot takes on us for us today?
I'll do my best.
All right. Duck South user sent in a question. He is having trouble with the brand new dog and it holding. Are there any tips that you can give this Duck South user on how to make his dog hold after he sits?
Okay, are you talking about hold as in not breaking, or hold as in holding a dummy in his mouth?
No, hold as in when he sits, he tells the dog to sit and he walks away to keep the dog in the sitting position.
Okay, so we're talking about keeping the dog sitting in place.
That's correct.
All right. Well, typically when we talk about teaching a dog to hold, we're talking about the initial stage of force fetch, where we teach the dog to hold the dummy. So that's what had me thrown off there just a little bit. Basically, you're talking about teaching the dog to stay in place. Yeah, I can give you a couple of really, really good ones. The first technique that we use when we're teaching a dog to sit and stay in place when we walk away is a technique that we call looming. And looming is where, you know, you just make yourself bigger than the dog. Imagine, you know, the traffic cop sort of does this when he holds his hand out. That's kind of looming over, you know, showing some dominance there and, hey, stop. And we do the same thing with the dog. You know, I'll raise my hands up above my shoulders or above my head with my palms out and my fingers spread, you know, to make myself much bigger than the dog, and tell the dog, sit, sit, sit as I move away. And then the second thing that I'm going to do in addition to looming over the dog is if the dog starts to move, I'm immediately going to go back, pick the dog's leash up, put the dog in a sitting position again, and start to move away over and over. So we're going to use the looming technique to try to get the dog to stay in place. And we also, whenever the dog moves, we're going to come in consistently every time, put the dog back in that exact same spot where it was sitting, and start trying to move away again. And eventually you'll wind up, if you're consistent with it, with a dog that through attrition just finally says, okay, I'm going to sit, because if I start to stand up, he's going to come back and put me back in place anyway. Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, Jay Paul, I've got a dog question real quick that's related to something that's about to happen across the whole Southeast, at least, is dove season is right around the corner. And a lot of guys are excited. We're all excited. And I think a lot of guys are also really excited to get their dog out there with them. It's the kind of the first time they really get to put a lot of the work they've been doing in the summer and start concentrating it on retrieving, hunting and retrieving. But what do you see as the biggest no-no for somebody to do if they're going to take their dog dove hunting?
Well, first of all, I'm going to give you three things here. Number one, if you've got a new dog and this is your first year hunting with that dog, do not make that dog's first hunt a dove hunt. You know, I think a dove hunt is about the worst place that you can possibly begin with a new dog, because first of all, doves don't circle. They just come flying in. They're hard for the dogs to pick up. It's generally hot. They do not scent them very well. They tend to not see them fall. So for a young dog, new dog, first hunting experience, skip the dove hunt. That's number one. Number two, if you've got a dog that is an experienced hunter and you want to take them dove hunting, that is fine. But keep in mind, that more dogs are lost in a hunting situation on opening day of dove season every year than through the rest of the year, pretty much combined. And that's because of heat. Every single year, I hear of someone, and I mean every year, I can't remember a year that I have it, sometimes multiple, you know, guys who had dogs go down due to heat exhaustion. A lot of them survive, but are never the same. And, you know, quite frequently, somebody doesn't recognize the signs and they're not prepared, you know, that dog perishes. So, you know, you really need to be mindful of the heat and the stress that it's putting on the dog. You want to have plenty of water on hand. And then number three, if you are going to go out there hunting with that dog on opening day of dove season, be prepared to cool them off. Know the signs of overheating and be prepared to take action. And, you know, a dog that's starting to overheat, they're generally going to become, act like they're a little bit disoriented. They're going to be, go from, you know, panting, which is the dog's way of exchanging, giving off heat, to trying to breathe even deeper, which is not effective for dogs. Sometimes they're going to even refuse water. And the best thing you can do is cool that dog down as fast as you can. When I go out dove hunting on opening day, I generally take a number three wash tub and two or three bags of ice in a cooler along with my dog. And I'll take a bag of ice and throw in the bottom of that wash tub and just let it start melting and let the dog, you know, jump in and out as the dog wants to. I'll have another bag where, hey, if I do need to cool the dog down really fast, you know, I can dump it in there and make the dog lay down in it. So, you know, my three keys when it comes to dove hunting with your dog: number one, don't make it your dog's first hunt. Number two, be mindful of the heat, and, you know, are you making a good decision to take the dog at all? Number three, if you do take your dog, you know, in those early days of dove season, know the signs of overheating and be prepared to deal with them.
Jay Paul, hey, I know I hadn't told you this on the podcast in front of all the listeners before, but man, it is really a blessing to have you on here to give us great tips about dogs, because most of the people that are listening to this podcast are dog owners. They use a dog while hunting, and man, I just appreciate it. And guys, look, if you have any more questions or need any more tips, training tips ever about dogs, please visit trainingwithjaypaul.com. Also, Jay Paul has a link that you could type in, askjaypaul.com, that you can ask him a question. He'll probably send you a video, do a video on that question. But sure. Look, check out trainingwithjaypaul.com, and he has tons of video, tons of content that for you to look at as you're working with your dog, and use the Ask Jay Paul. Jay Paul is very gracious, and any time that you have a question, he'll be more than happy to answer for. So trainingwithjaypaul.com.
Thanks, man. Rocky, I appreciate that. You know, Melanie and I, we do love what we do, and I enjoy helping people with their dogs, even if I'm not the one training, and I really appreciate that, Rocky, a whole lot. And speaking of dogs, we're about to be joined here in just a moment by our special guest this week, Freddie King. But before we are, let me give a quick shout-out to the folks from Hardcore Decoys and Hardcore Brands International. Hardcore is making some of the best decoys, and coming out, I've seen behind the black curtain, we've got some great apparel, some great new blind bags. And yes, folks, not for 2016, but in 2017, I even hear they're going to be hardcore waiters. Hardcore. It's not easy being hardcore. Okay, folks, I'm pretty sure that I just heard the beep announcing that our special guest this week, Freddie King, has joined us. Freddie, are you there?
I am here, brother. How you been doing?
Man, I've been doing great, brother. So good to hear you on the line with us.
Well, I hope everything's good. I've got a lot of loud dogs in the back of my rig right now, and they're just the ambient noise might be fulfilling for what we're doing.
Yeah, and for those of you who don't know Freddie very well, of course, among other things, Freddie's kind of a jack of all trades. I mean, he's a tremendous videographer and camera guy, heck of a duck hunter, one of the best timber hunters that I know, a great editor, but he is also a very good dog trainer, and he has joined us as he is leaving the West Tennessee Hunting Retriever Club hunt test in Union City, Tennessee. So how many dogs you got on the truck with you right now, Freddie?
Well, we ran 6 dogs this weekend, and I'm happy to say we were 12 for 12 both days. So we just, that's pretty strong, which I got a good crew. And Jay Paul, you know, being no stranger to dog training yourself, you know that when you got a strong crew, you can do something like that, especially when they're a young, strong crew. And I'm fortunate to have one right now. And a lot of times they're not.
Yeah, it's always great when you've got a lot of confidence, you know, walking to the line, because you know that you've got a really strong string of dogs on your truck. I'll be headed to the Music City's hunt test in 2 weeks with 10 dogs, and 8 of them are very young and I think pretty strong. But I understand exactly what you were looking at this weekend. 12 for 12 is awesome. Congratulations.
Well, good. I'll see you in Music City as well, brother.
Cool. We hadn't ran together in a while.
No, we sure hadn't. Well, let's talk about some ducks. What are y'all thinking about this upcoming duck season?
Well, what I want to know, Freddie, is why we've got to focus on ducks is, I think a big part of your internet fame be your boat rides, and I want to know how bad the guys at XL cringe when you send them video footage of what you're putting their rigs through.
Well, you know, they did a little deal. You know, they you know, you have research and development. They sent me a bunch of shirts one time that said research and destroy. So I was the R&D department for a while, and I tell you what, the boys at XL done a real good job of following my lead. Exactly, you know, where I'd say there were trouble spots and what needed to be fixed and what not to be, you know, what needed to be done on boats before they hit the market and stuff. Just, you know, that's a major part of coming out with a great product that can withstand the type of grueling punishment that the Echo boys put on their rigs day in, day out of a 60-day duck season, you know. Yeah.
Well, I think that's cool. It shows their customer service, you know, side of things is top notch, and that they're really looking out for the hunters.
Well, it's even more so in today's market with social media. You have to be on top of your products more than ever, because, I mean, if you're not, bad word comes around awful quick.
Yeah, it definitely does. You know, and one of the most impressive things to me about the XL boat, because, you know, I've been with you and watched the way you run them, and, of course, I've had 3 or 4 of my own. Those guys truly believe that there is no such thing as overbuilt. I mean, I've been to the factory out there in Salt Lake City, Utah, and I'm not trying to turn this into an XL boat commercial by any means, but the fact of the matter is, you know, out there where they put the Mud Buddies together, they are looking to build the most durable motor that they can. And then, you know, at the factory over in Arkansas for the boats, I mean, DJ and the guys over there, the extra bracing, that, you know, time that they spend making sure that they have all of their welds and all of their stress points reinforced, it's pretty impressive that, you know, they're trying to build a tank for the water, it looks to me like. Of course, with you running them, Freddie, hell, they need to.
Well, you know, I get blamed for probably being a little excessive, but in all reality, I might do a few things every now and then that's a little bit excessive, but we generally run our boats pretty doggone hard when we're in the timber, you know. And, I mean, you got to have a boat that can withstand. You got to have the gear. I mean, if you're going to be a successful duck hunter this day and time, and you know, and I hate to say it just because, you know, I love all my duck hunting brethren, but it's turned into it's a strong competition still. And you've got to have gear that can withstand it, a 60-day, hardcore 60-day season. That's all there is to it, you know. And XL Boats, they provide the product. Mud Buddy does the same thing, as does all our sponsors and stuff that we deal with. But, you know, not to turn this thing into some kind of infomercial, I mean, this year is looking like probably one of our top-notch duck season numbers are up, so they claim. And last year, you know, they said the same thing, and I think I could tell a little bit of difference in the duck numbers. I think it was up, and I'm just hoping for a little bit more of the same. We already got the water coming in, boys. That ain't no doubt.
Hey, Freddie, it's Houston. I am actually on my way back from kind of driving around Dave Donaldson this morning, headed back home, and talking about big woods and running through the timber. I mean, the way you guys ride, have you ever made anybody wear a cup before when you ride in the timber as fast as you do?
Not a cup, but I guarantee you they wore motorcycle helmets and other type of goggles and stuff like that, protective eyewear. And I have too myself, to tell you the truth, every now and then.
Hey, Freddie, on talking about everybody that y'all are affiliated with, you've been with Echo for a long time. But how long has that been? You've been hanging out with those boys for as long as I can remember.
Well, I mean, we're on Mounted Madness 10 right now. And before that, we did two series called Timber Heat. And so, bona fidely filming strictly their stuff, I have been doing it for, you know, a solid 12 years. But, you know, I've been around the Echo guys for a good 15 years. And, you know, we're just like family. I mean, we're a tight-knit group of guys, and not a better group for getting done what we need to get done in 60 days, you know, in front of the camera, off the camera. You know, it turns into a job trying to get a quality DVD out, and these guys are tight. Everybody has a job. They know what they need to do. They know where to scout. We'll split up. We'll go a couple of different directions, and, you know, that's one of the reasons we're pretty much successful at duck hunting is because everybody works hard at it. Nobody attacks duck season with a lackadaisical attitude.
Well, I think when you hit on the scouting, that really brought in something I wanted to bring to the table is the amount of scouting that y'all do, and it helps y'all be so consistent. But can you talk a little bit about, you know, just how much time is spent scouting and being in those woods?
Oh, half our duck hunting time. I mean, there's no doubt that we spend half our duck hunting time scouting. So, and when I say half, 50% of our time we're duck hunting, 50% we're scouting. And you have got to do that. And if we're set up in the morning, we're seeing duck traffic in one way. If we can get to where we can do a little bit of looking and not bother anybody, we're going to go check in. Now, that's one thing we will adhere to. We won't run in on somebody. If there's somebody banging in over an area and we know ducks are in that area, we won't go and mess with those birds. We'll try to figure a way to short stop them or get on the tail end of things. So, and a lot of times we do our scouting by boat. A lot of times we do it by road. And it's amazing knowing the ducks in the area, where they're roosting, where they're feeding, where they're loafing, how much scouting you can get done just from the windshield of your truck by taking a good pair of binoculars and looking over the tops of the woods in the afternoons. Because a lot of places you can't get on after 1 o'clock. This year it's going to be noon. So a lot of places we scout strictly from the truck using a really good pair of glasses, watching the flyways, watching where the ducks are coming back from to roost in certain areas that we know to be haunts. Now, if we see ducks piling up on the river somewhere, we know where those birds are going to go to leaving that area 90% of the time. And that just comes from years of hunting. And I'll have to be quite honest, Rick Dunn has taught me a lot about duck travel and especially the places that we call home.
Freddie, you talk about scouting. Have you guys ever used the drone for scouting before?
No, it would be a great tool, but I honestly think that a lot of the game and fish areas that we hunt, a lot of the federal grounds, you're not allowed to fly them.
That's exactly right. I mean, you run into a lot of different legal issues when it comes to utilizing a drone for scouting, and also you know, there's some people that I think have ethical questions about that. You know, I would be one of those. I think that a drone, and this is, you know, from my standpoint as a more traditional hunter too, and being from an older generation, I would think that a drone would give you a very unfair advantage. And because of that, that is recognized by some state and federal agencies. You cannot fly Houston an aircraft over even a small single engine plane. For instance, Realfoot Lake, it's illegal to fly a single engine plane over the lake.
That's correct. That's correct. And there's a lot of areas. Well, I mean, all the wildlife management areas in Arkansas that are state owned, you're not allowed to operate a drone on them. But I'm with you 100%. The way we do it is old school, pretty much, and it works. And you know, like Daddy always said, if it works, don't fix it.
Quick question, real quick, back to Echo. For somebody that's new to duck hunting, looking for a good call that's going to produce a good sound, what would you recommend, Freddie?
Well, I mean, there's different levels. Okay, now, if you're a novice wanting a solid duck call that's easy to learn, you know, always just start with your basic trash talker call that's going to cost you less than $20. It's a double reed. It's a real ducky call. Anybody can blow it, but it's a great call to learn how to blow hot air, how to control a call, and get started to where, you know, that's what I try, you know, depending on where you're at, that's what I try to lead people in toward a call. So if you're a novice, stick with something like the trash talker. Now, if on the far end of the spectrum, if you know, if you're an accomplished duck caller, got great control and can, you know, pinch a call down and know how to blow good, solid, low, hot air in them, then, you know, the breaker is going to be a great call for you. It's one of my favorite. I'm not the greatest duck caller in the world by any means, but it's a call that I will not blow over the top of. And when I say that, I won't squeal it, and I can get very low with it, and I can sound, at least I think I sound like a duck.
Yeah, Freddie, well, I've heard you, and I can say you definitely do sound really ducky. Now, you know, you mentioned two or three different calls in. Tell us what the differences are between those specific models.
Well, the breaker call is a single reed call, and it's acrylic. And with that call, you're going to have a lot more tone change to it. You're going to be able to squeeze that call down, get some nice whiny, soft sounds out of it, and you know, and you'll do that just by kind of squeezing your diaphragm and your note with the roof of your mouth and the tongue. And then that call is going to be extremely versatile, the breaker will be. It'll be a call that you can get real loud, can hunt a little bit of open water, get ducks' attention from a pretty good distance. Then you can finish the ducks off with some light quacks and a barkity bark bark, as Freddie King likes to say. But the trash talker is a great call. It's a double reed, but it's not going to have the range. It's not ever going to be as loud. But that call is a great finishing call. And even if you're a pro, you're going to find that the trash talker call, even though it's a $20 call versus a $140 call, is going to be, you know, an asset at times for finishing birds. And on in the same regards, the XLT, which, you know, is a timber call, extra loud timbers, what that stands for, it's going to be a real versatile call with an extremely, extremely good low end to it. And it's not going to be quite as loud as the breaker, but it's going to definitely be able to enhance those soft note, quacky duck sounds that birds make, especially when they're on the water, just kind of milling around looking for whatnot out there. That call will be very, very, very ducky.
Well, I know I can speak directly to the timber call, because I've had one on my lanyard for a while. And I want to focus on another very important part of a lot of guys that duck hunt, and that's their best little furry friend that sits next to them, a dog. And I know for a long time you had Teal next to you. And so can you speak a little bit as to what it means to have a dog and one that truly loves duck hunting as much as you do?
Well, I mean, there's anybody that's hunted with a great dog or even a good dog will honestly say that they add something to a hunt. They, you know, being able to, you know, shooting the birds is one thing and the camaraderie is another thing, but that dog, a good dog, will add so much to a hunt. Just being able to enjoy watching them work, watching them enjoy the hunt just as much as actually we do, if not more. And you know, saving game, because they'll retrieve a lot of birds that a hunter can't get to, and birds that are crippled getting away, they'll catch up to that. So they say they're a very, very good tool. And I hate to call a dog a tool, but they're a great tool for making sure more ducks go in the bag. And, but the main thing that I honestly think that dogs add to duck hunting is a pure fact that they, kind of hard to explain to me, they just bring your duck hunting to another level. Because once you have dogs out there that are great dogs, you'll find yourself duck hunting a lot for the dog. Am I making sense with that? In other words, you want to take that dog just so that they can have fun, make some great retrieves, and enjoy watching. So I find myself a lot of times just going duck hunting to watch the dog, for the dog.
No, you totally make sense. I mean, you know, as a fellow dog trainer, I could tell you, hunting with a dog, after you've done it with a really good one, and I've been so blessed, you know, first I had Maddie and then Ella, and most recently I've been hunting a lot with Rain. And to me, it's just totally different without the dog. When I go without a dog, and I have to sometimes, one of the best elements of the hunt is just missing. So, you know, and for those who've never done it, you definitely need to try it. I cannot imagine not hunting on a regular basis without a dog, because they just bring so much more enjoyment to the hunt for me. But they've got to be really well trained, and they've got to be under control too.
Well, that's just it. It's kind of like I tell everybody, there's nothing like a great dog, and there's nothing worse than a bad.
Amen. Amen. I've got another question. Go ahead.
Well, no, I was just going to reiterate that, you know, you take a bad duck, with a bunch of buddies duck hunting, you're liable to not get an invite back.
Amen. Definitely there are times when, you know, having the wrong dog, having one that's not trained right is going to be a big liability. And there's nothing I hate more than to go out in the field with somebody and, you know, they say, oh yeah, you know, I want to hunt with my dog. He's a great hunting dog. And then we get out there and this dog will not honor my dog. I mean,
oh no.
Folks, if you're going to hunt with somebody else with a trained retriever, make dang sure your dog is steady. There's nothing more aggravating than somebody whose dog breaks on every single bird, you know, and to me, that will ruin a hunt faster than anything.
Well, I learned a long time ago, even though, you know, I consider my dogs to be great honoring dogs, no matter what, I'll put a lead in my bag when I hit the woods, just because you just never know what kind of dog you got a lot of times in certain situations. And I'll put my dog on the lead the first time we have issues, just because, you know, like we said, a bad dog can ruin a hunt and make it less memorable. So there's nothing wrong with putting your dog on a lead and snapping them to a tree and just letting them work, you know, single birdly, as I'd like to say.
Yeah,
You guys talked about working with dogs and being able to take them, being your best friends hunting with you. How do you work on whining? I mean, both of you guys are trainers. Kind of talk a little about whining. That's one of the problems with my dog, is she gets so jacked up that she starts to whine. And, you know, how do you fix that, and what can I do?
Well, J-Ball can attest to this. A whining dog is probably one of the hardest habits to break once they get started in it. It's an extremely annoying habit, and it's extremely hard to break. So, and there's several different methods. I don't think any one of them is tried and true. Some dogs I've broke as simple as every time they started to whine, I grabbed their muzzle and told them quiet. And through just simple repetition, they've learned, okay, be quiet, be quiet, be quiet. Some dogs, they're so aggressive with it that I've carried a bottle of lemon juice, just stop at the local Walmart and grab that little round lemon, little swing lemon you might use in a Tata or something like that. And every time they whine, I'd squirt a big old mouthful of that daggum lemon juice in there. And I've had that work with dogs. But there, to me, is no tried and true method other than complete repetition and staying on that dog about whining.
Yeah, I agree with Freddie. It is very, very difficult to break. I mean, I've been training dogs for over 20 years now, and I've had several whining dogs. But it's not impossible. You know, the one thing that I will tell you that I believe you should never do with a dog that vocalizes is try to correct it with electricity. You know, I've seen guys that want to shock their dog when the dog whines, and that just causes the dog to vocalize more.
Yeah. I mean, there's the best way is through an attrition type repetition that focuses it directly on exactly what's going on in that area. And the muzzle, holding the muzzle quiet, or that lemon juice to me, I think has worked better than anything else.
I've never tried that. I'll have to give that a try.
I hate the lemon juice.
But I think consistency is the key. I mean, it goes along with what you're saying there, Freddie. You know, however you're going to do it, you need to do the same thing, and you need to make a correction every time. Whining,
exactly.
Vocalization at the line or in the blind is something that you need to adopt a zero tolerance policy from the get-go. Every single time that dog makes a noise, I'm going to give a correction, whether it's grabbing them by the muzzle, telling them to hush, you know, correcting it with a healing stick, correcting it with a squirt of lemon juice, whatever. We're going to be zero tolerant. We're going to be consistent. And every single time that dog makes a noise, boom, a correction is going to follow.
That's it. And, you know, and the bad thing about it is a lot of times, 90% of times, you're going to have to hang your gun up and deal with it while you're hunting. And, you know, let your buddies shoot, let your buddies call and stuff. But trust me, after, like Dave Paul's saying, just the consistent repetition, they'll eventually learn. It's the same difference as housebreaking a dog. You just got to be consistent about it.
All right, Freddie, yeah. You talk about hanging your gun up. When you hang a gun up and dig in your bag, all the fat boys want to know what you're going to dig out.
Well, I tell you what. Now, if you're talking about eats, you're liable to find anything from Yoo-Hoo bars or Yo-Ha or whatever you call them to daggum Dunkin' Donut coffee sticks to Slim Jim. And one thing about the Echo Boys I found out a long time ago is I think we could actually survive for about the second weekend of season. We accumulate so much stuff that we didn't know we had in our bag that I think we could survive for about 4 days out there on our own.
Yeah, but I'd be scared to peel the wrapper off of some of that stuff.
Oh, no. I think stuff that I found in there from last year. What are you talking about?
Man, I've dug through your blind bag before while we've been hunting together, and you never know what you're going to find in there. I can remember you one time telling me, oh, yeah, you get in those cheese and crackers, they're okay. And after I took the first bite of one, I was like, man, how long have these been in here? And you were like, well, I ate the first two out of there about a week and a half ago.
Oh,
yeah, but,
well.
You know, in the past when I've got to hunt with you most of the time, Freddie, you've been behind a camera. How often do you actually get to pick up the gun and shoot yourself?
You know, I probably about 10% of the season. It kind of depends on the situation, but about 10-15% of the time, I actually will get to hunt. If it's a slow hunt that we're pretty certain not a lot's going to go on, and we're going to be spending a lot of time afterwards scouting. I may film a few little sunrise shots. I'll bring my camera every single time, no matter what, because you never, ever know what might happen. So, and if it looks like a barn burner, then, you know, hey, I'm fixing to film it. And if it's just going to be one of those days where we're going to kill, you know, 6-7 ducks, and it's going to kind of linger out, you know, to 8:30 morning to where we're going to possibly get out there and do some scouting. You know, I'll sit in and shoot maybe a single or two if we're happy to get lucky. And there's times where the Echo Boys, we've had a really solid hunt, and they've killed their birds, and I've got them all on film, and somebody stepped behind the camera and filmed me shooting my birds. That's happened several times the last few years. So I get a little reward every now and then.
Cool. I'm glad to hear that, because I tell you what, you know, I've been with you a whole lot. I've heard you blow a duck call. I've seen you work dogs. I've seen you behind the camera. But I know how much you love hunting. And, you know, the amazing thing to me is it seems like, you know, when I've been with you, whether you're looking at them down a gun barrel or you're looking at them through the lens of the camera, you feel like you're hunting and you're out there as part of the hunt. Is that pretty true?
Well, you hit the nail on the head. I mean, no matter if I – through the lens, I get just as much enjoyment out of that as I do actually pulling the trigger. And as long as I'm part of the hunt, and that's why you hear me talking a lot from behind the camera, you hear me blowing a duck call. I'm filming and blowing a duck call and talking to the guys at the same time. And I'm part of the team, and I get just as much enjoyment out of pushing record as I do with pulling the trigger. I can guarantee you that.
Okay, guys, well, we're just about out of time here, so we need to go on and close it out. As always, Freddie, we thank you so much for being part of the podcast today. And before we close it, I want to give everybody one chance for a final word. Rocky LaFleur, to you first, buddy.
First off, Freddie, I just want to thank you for being here and thank you for the knowledge that you shared with all of our listeners today. And you're welcome back here anytime, buddy.
Well, I really enjoyed it, guys. I really, really did. Y'all just holler at me anytime.
All right, Josh Webb, to you.
Freddie, again, I just really appreciate you taking the time on your way home today to call in and talk with us. From day one, you've been a true friend to me and my family, and I can't thank you enough for just being there and being a true friend every time we're around each other.
Well, brother, you know the feeling's mutual, and I sure can't wait to get back in them turkey woods with you one day.
And how about you, Houston Kennedy?
Hey, Freddie, thanks again for being on the podcast with us, and I'm definitely going to try out that lemon juice tip. Thank you very much.
All right, buddy. Let me know how that goes now.
I'll do it.
All right, guys. Well, that wraps us up this week. Thank you for joining me, J. Paul Jackson, along with my co-hosts, Josh Webb, Houston Kennedy, Rocky LaFleur, and our special guest this week, Mr. Freddie King, on the On X podcast, powered by DuckSouth.com.